Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. After dear listeners, welcome to today's chapter of the Big Picture Show here live on Radio Islam International, and a special welcome to our Radio Al Ansar listeners via live feed. I'm your host for today, Mustafa Darsot. Well, at the moment, the buzzword is coalitions. Well, what is a coalition? A coalition is a marriage of convenience. And right now, we're having this marriages of convenience coming about, whether it's the major metros of city of Johannesburg, Tshwane, which is Pretoria, Ekurhuleni, the East Rand, or Itakwini, Durban, as well as a whole host of smaller municipalities throughout the country. And it's going to be very interesting, although coalitions do not work very well. In fact, the South African political climate is not ready for coalitions. We've seen it in 2016 when we tried to have a coalition in Tshwane, city of Johannesburg, and Nelson Mandela Bay, and what has happened thereafter. But the thing is that going forward, coalitions is the way to go in the political climate in this country, because the majority ruling party, which has been traditionally the ANC, has seen a decline in power. Well, there's certain pluses out of coalitions as well. It keeps the parties all on their toes. And of course, it leads to a certain level of transparency, yes. However, the downside is that if there's an agreement between the various party big chiefs to say, listen, we can share the loot together, then corruption perpetuates. And that's a downside which is very hard to monitor. However, it's left to be seen how things unfold. Now we're having a situation here in Itakwini whereby it's been announced that the IFP will work with the ANC and all the other smaller parties in running the city of Durban, whereby the ANC will retain the status quo of running the city and the mayorship. The IFP has insisted that we are not in a coalition, but we will work together with the ANC. In other words, vote on in favor and supporting for the mayor election, or should I say the election of the mayor to continue the running of the city. The city of Ekurhuleni seems to be on the ticket of the ANC. However, there is still no finality yet, and which leaves the other two major metros of Tshwane and city of Johannesburg. There's been a lot of speculation out there that the DA is taking Pretoria and the Action SA will be taking Johannesburg, but that's all speculation. All I know is that there's a robust engagement taking place, and we need to see what happens. And the deadline is set for this coming Tuesday, the 23rd of October, whereby these coalitions must be announced, failing which we run the risk of re-election or a by-election, which is good and bad. In the good, in the sense that whoever didn't vote the last time or was sleeping should wake up and now exercise that vote, and hopefully we get a better outcome. And the bad part is that it could result in a negative outcome. So it's left to be seen. Now, staying on the local scene, very disturbing news has come out yesterday on the crime stats in this country. And just this week, we've heard the sad kidnapping of a 9-year-old child outside her school in Mayfair, of which the family owns the famous Palm Continental Hotel in on the corner of Church Street and Main Reef Road in Mayfair. And this is so disturbing. We just lived through the horrors of the four Moti boys who were released recently and reunited with their parents. And now you have this. And then again, there was another attempted kidnapping of a matric child also, and was willing to fight back. And there's been other attempted kidnappings. A person known to me here in Durban by the name of Salim Tebo was kidnapped 3 weeks ago as well. A person who is low profile, is not even a wealthy person because he works for somebody, right? And the thing is that you're having all sorts of situations taking place. And the thing is that you have a government that's totally impotent, incompetent, and a police force that's absolutely useless. And then you have the crime stats that were released yesterday, whereby Becky Kelly, our police minister, has the audacity to say that he will be optimistic. And listen to this. He says he can only be optimistic about the crime situation when the murder rate drops. right? He even raised the alarm that there were almost 10,000 reported rape cases in just the past 3 months alone, right? He was speaking about in the 3 months being the second quarter of this year, right? And he was speaking about these crime stats that were on the release, that were released this past Friday. And he says that violent crime was on the rise with double-figure percentages increases in murder at just over 20%. And I'll give you some of these crime stats. Like in KZN, murder has gone up by 44.4% in KZN, right? In Gauteng, it's gone up by 21%. Okay, because that you must also put in the July unrest murders of about, say, 350 roughly, right? Then you have overall, right, contact crimes. So if you look at it, murder up by 20.7%, attempted murder 4.4%, assault to do grievous bodily harm 21%. I mean, take the number of people that were killed between July and September, 6,163. Sexual offenses, close to 10,000, 9,556, right? Cash in transit, heists, well, they've been down by 18.8%. But let's take the biggest business in transit heist, which was the July riots, 50 billion rand plus damage to the economy, right? 150,000 people out of job. And much more bigger repercussions going forward. So Kelly says that rape remained high, and it's calling it a disgrace for the country. Well, I want to, and then coming to kidnappings. Kidnappings are increasingly rising, right? With 2,000 cases recorded in just 3 months. Kelly said this was a new category of crime, and the police were monitoring closely. What the hell does he mean by new category of crime? Kidnappings were always there, but it was always very little, very small. It was basically petty kidnapping over domestic squabbles, over family feuds, over a person owing another person money. But now you're having this rise of kidnapping for ransom, and we're talking millions and millions of rands. And he calls it a new category of crime. It started off in Mozambique 10 years ago, and the signs were telling to South Africa that it's going to spread here if we do not get our act together, if we are not alert and not vigilant. And yet it's come right within our borders. And he calls it a new category of crime. What nonsense is that? So going on about the crime stats, right, that it emerged from that the police in KZN were allegedly asked to step down during the deadly riots in July that took place across the KZN and parts of Gauteng, which left over 300, of course, up to 350 people dead and caused billions of rands, up to 50 billion and plus in damages. And this is according to the Pietermaritzburg and Midlands Chamber of Commerce Chief Executive Menene Venness, right? She said the events that took place in July appeared to be an orchestrated hit because the rioters used the same modus operandi on all shopping complexes or infrastructure systems that were destroyed. Right? Now, she was speaking at the recent Commission of Inquiry that's been held by the South African Human Rights Commission, acronym SARC. Right? She was speaking on day four of its hearing as part of its probe into the effects and causal factors behind the unrest, which started shortly after the jailing of former President Zuma. Right? And speaking of this Commission of Inquiry, it's another big mess. Right? Now, let me tell you what has been uncovered about this, right? That this is just another form of window dressing or politicking, or should I say political scoring on behalf of the ANC to try and claim the moral higher ground, if one wants to put it that way. And according to the famous William Saunderson Mayer, who writes as the jaundiced eye, right? He says that the SARC inquiry, he actually, his headline is titled The SARC's Phoenix Charade. So SARC is SAHRC, right, South African Human Rights Commission, Phoenix Charade. And why does he call it a charade? Well, according to him, a feminist, a minister, and a recycled politician walk into a room. Right? According to this, right, and it's quoted here, give us $3 million in 3 weeks, and we'll tell you why at least 359 people died. 50 billion rand of property was damaged, and 150,000 jobs were put at risk. Right? So he's saying, no, this is not a riff or an old joke, and risible though it may seem, it's a reality. The South African Human Rights Commission, a fully owned subsidiary, which he calls it a fully owned subsidiary of ANC Pty Limited, has been delegated by President Cyril Ramaphosa, right, who is the CEO of the aforesaid, meaning the ANC Pty Limited, to determine the cause of the July public violence that wrecked KZN and parts of Gauteng. Right? There are three commissioners, no investigatory staff, but all already obvious, a clear agenda. So you've got this three people that are manning this commission, no investigation unit, like how you have at the Zondo Commission, for example, right? And a clear-cut agenda. So the feminist is a person by name of Philile Ntuli. She has two higher degrees in gender studies, and her biography states, my life's work focuses on women's relationship with the state. Right? She is particularly interested in exploring how whether South Africa's project of democratization can disrupt historical gendered hierarchies. The minister is the Reverend Chris Neeson, ordained in the United Presbyterian Church and a part-time commissioner. Neeson is a lifelong ANC activist. He served in the Western Cape Provincial Government as the ANC's MEC for Economic Affairs and then as Deputy Speaker until 1999. Neeson was SARC's point man in last year's five-month-long occupation of Cape Town's Central Methodist Church by around 900 Congolese illegal immigrants. If you remember, they were victims of xenophobia, and they seized the church because they wanted safe passage to Canada. Right? And what happened at that was that eventually there was a breakdown, and he was sent to negotiate them. Right, the new home, it went upside down, and of course he was actually physically attacked, so as other church leaders. And then the recycled politician. So we've had the feminists, we've had the minister. Now the recycled politician is the head of the triumvirate advocate Andre Guam. Right? For 14 years he was an ANC MP, during which period he served briefly as Deputy Minister of Education in Zuma's cabinet. Now, the inquiry's stated objectives are revealing. The first aim of this hopelessly underpowered team is to establish the causes of the unrest. Also, to determine the cause of the racially motivated attacks, the cause of any lapses in law enforcement, and the role played by social, economic, spatial, and political factors. Just in case you haven't yet launched onto which preordained direction of scapegoating this is going, Guam is frank. The focus, Guam told the media, is on the numerous incidents of race violence. So this is supposed to be an inquiry about the entire July matter, but he says it's on the numerous incidents of race violence. That came on the latter end of the whole thing. What started it? What created it? It started on that Sunday night, the 11th of July. It carried on for a few days. And what happened with the race violence was on the latter part. So the article continues to say that the entire charade is classic Ramaphosa sleight of hand. Instead of a fully-fledged judicial inquiry such as that headed by Deputy Chief Justice Raymond Zondo into state capture, which of course has cost the country 1 billion rand in over 3 years, Ramaphosa hopes to distract attention from the real causes of the riots by examining a single microcosm, much safer than the judicial inquiry is to deploy the party's lackeys at the South African Human Rights Commission. So there is good reason for Ramaphosa's move to dig deeply and even-handedly into the entire equation. Instead of just this particular subset, would be to risk an ANC political implosion. So there's plenty of evidence that the riots started when Ramaphosa, after years of trying to avoid the scenario, allowed the jailing of former President Zuma for an effective 8 months on a contempt of court charge. In response, members of Zuma's RET faction openly promoted sedition on social media, and of course, as we know, all hell broke loose. So Ramaphosa initially described this as an attempted insurrection organized by a party cabal. The ANC announced that it had evidence fingering as chief instigators a dozen senior party members. Then it, of course, dawned on Ramaphosa that he was over a barrel. To continue along this road would be to split the party and likely end his presidency in an early recall. And we know how good the ANC is with recalls. Remember Thabo Mbeki, Jacob Zuma, and Ramaphosa ran that risk as well. And he runs that risk because he thinks he has all the time in the world to get house in order, that we have the ANC elective conference coming up in about 13 months from now, that's December 2022, and if he does not get re-elected as ANC president, right, he can be recalled from the presidency of the country, just like his predecessors Thabo Mbeki and Jacob Zuma. So going on, the backpedaling has been total to date. None of the ANC instigators have been arrested. Zuma, who spent not a night in a cell, has been freed on mysterious medical grounds. Instead, all the ANC's investigatory zeal has been diverted to a single set of events in the Phoenix area outside Durban, where 33 alleged looters who were African were alleged murdered by vigilantes who were allegedly Indian. While the July deaths were undoubtedly horrific, witnesses have vividly recounted being attacked because of their race. There's no great mystery to unravel here. Aside from the obvious immediate threat that Phoenix residents faced during the 4 days of mob rampages, right, during which the police were conspicuously absent, there were at least two other good reasons to be worried. Now, go back to 1949 and to 1985. Phoenix saw violence of the sort. And now you've got the present-day situation that took place in July. Right, so it is laudatory to seek to unravel the many social, political, and economic roots of South Africa's perpetually violent society, but it's not South African Human Rights Commission's intention here, albeit bloody and tragic. The Phoenix Inquiry is a political slideshow that allows the government to advance two agendas, the pernicious prevalence of racism among minority groups and the ANC's intention to limit drastically citizen firearm ownership. And that's been the big aim, to limit that owning of your firearms. And this has been Becky Keller's agenda, right? And no wonder crime has gone out of control, because he's not focusing on fighting crime. He's focusing on other things just to score political points. So Becky Keller, who displayed stunning indifference to what happened with tenfold intensity elsewhere during the violence, focused massive investigatory resources on Phoenix. Despite all the efforts, only three men have been arrested and held without bail for a single alleged murder. The other target has been security companies. A Phoenix company which accuses Kelly of naming innocent people has been involved in the violence, had its entire armory seized as part of the 152 security company guns taken for ballistic analysis. Despite no matches being found, it has cost two high court applications to compel the police to return the firearms. Right? So although Guam stressed that the inquiry would be an inquisitional, not prosecutorial process, the tone at times suggests otherwise. The first witness, Sham Maraj, an old anti-apartheid activist now involved in the Phoenix Peace Group that seeks to reconcile the two communities, was harried mercilessly because he declined to describe the killings as a massacre. Right? Since the deaths did not take place in a single event, Maraj is grammatically correct, but the South African Human Rights Commission has a preordained narrative that it is stitching together, and come or hell water, it's determinedly doing so. To discover the truth behind the 33 tragic deaths in Phoenix, as well as the 326 that occurred elsewhere in the country, cannot be accomplished by a cadre-dominated South African Human Rights Commission. It is, for example, not believable that Guam, a former cabinet colleague of Kelly and Ramaphosa, will now call them properly to account when they testify, as they intend to do. Right? So he says, and following the Phoenix inquiry, will the South African Human Rights Commission be getting around to the other 326 deaths, or is it going to just focus on this? If not, this is more than just another ANC stitch-up. It is outrageous or itself racist. The South African Human Rights Commission is a political tool and a bad joke. It makes a lot of sense. In fact, when I heard on the first day, when they on SAFM on the first 2 days, that it just started off with Phoenix. And this is about the entire July riots, or should I say the July riots in its entirety. And it starts off with Phoenix. So what are they trying to prove here? this is the ANC's way of claiming the moral high ground. They're doing something about it and to appease masses, but in fact, what they're trying to do is to further polarize society, which is absolutely sickening and disgusting. So another matter on locally that is, of course, making headlines is, of course, you know, Miss South Africa's wanting to attend the big Miss Universe event in Israel next month. So is Miss South Africa's big Miss Universe decision, which side of history will she choose? So uneasy is the head that wears a crown. This is a famous quote. So no phrase has rung truer for a South African than it has for Lalela Mswane, Miss South Africa 2021, the infamous quote from William Shakespeare's Henry IV Part II play has likely been ringing in the 24-year-old beauty queen's head, right, ballet dancer and an LLB graduate, right, for the past few weeks as she decides on the biggest decision of her life. Does she go to Israel for Miss Universe or does she listen to the South Africans telling her it's not a good look? Okay, this is likely a far cry to what she has been experiencing or expecting her first few weeks as the fairest of the land to be. It is not far-fetched to think that she would be settling into a newfound fame, the toast of the town, and a highly in-demand guest at exclusive events. She would be vying for designer attention, each time to get her to wear garments from the latest collections. She would be interviewed across media platforms, on the cover of magazines, talk show couches, and radio mics, all while smiling through it while wearing her sash and crown. And that smile would probably be, by now, a permanent and dazzling white smile plastered on her face, forever ready for a picture with admirers. We should be waiting in anticipation to see what her what her coach, Werner Wessels, has curated for her to wear at Miss Universe, where she would be taking on some of the most beautiful and intelligent women in the world to be crowned the fairest and hopefully perform as well as her predecessors, Zosie Bini Tumzi, Tamlin Green, and Demi Lee Thabo. Right? So this is what she's expected to face. And yet her life has gone from total freedom to, well, Rapunzel, as she has been caught in a political scandal that can ruin her life forever. When the news broke out that the Miss Universe organization has chosen Eilat, the city of Eilat in Israel, as the host of the 2021 competition, there were murmurs of how this would impact the pageant world. Israel's ongoing war with Palestine was immediately brought up in pageant discussions online, with many in solidarity with Palestine wanting the venue to be changed. Right? However, according to Paula Shugart, president of the Miss Universe organization, released in a statement in July saying that Israel was the perfect host country. And of course, given all the niceties that go with Israel, has been shortlisted of our host countries for a number of years due to its rich history, beautiful landscapes, myriad of cultures, and appeal as a global tourist destination. It became clear that Israel has the best resources to host Miss Universe. We look forward to deepening our commitment to creating meaningful cultural conversation, connection, and understanding through this partnership. Okay. So, of course, we all know what happened recently with the last Gaza war that took place in May this year. And, of course, all the, we've seen lots of violence taking place, the Sheikh Jarrah situation, ethnic cleansing of neighborhoods, as well as the, what the Israeli settlers are doing to cemeteries of Palestinians, turning graves upside down, digging up graves, as if, you know, it's just going one problem after the other. And for many, it was a reminder of where South Africa comes from, where displacement of black, indigenous people of color happened during the apartheid era. Hence, many South Africans took to the streets protesting against Israel's displacement of Palestinians. It hit too close to home. So now, with Mswane and the Miss South Africa organization insisting that they are taking part in the competition, the backlash has been swift and has led to the government withdrawing their support for the organization. And online and in-person boycotts have been happening, urging Miss South Africa not to participate in the Miss Universe. Which now brings us back to Mswane. What does she do? Diminishing the impact of a decision would be doing her a disservice it is a catch-22, of course. Does she, a young black woman from a country that is still reeling from the horrors of apartheid, continue to compete in a pageant hosted in a country with ongoing apartheid, even today, and by doing so, choose to ignore the history and turmoil of Israel and Palestine and go take part in Miss Universe? Or does she choose to rather stay at home and try her luck at Miss Universe 2022, even though she will anger parts of society and the famous accusation will be leveled at her as being anti-Semitic? What are the implications for each decision? Will she eventually be forgiven by either side, or will she be a pariah forever followed by an asterisk whenever she speaks up about the pertinent issue? But most importantly, does she actually have a choice in all this, or is she simply following that what Miss South Africa contract stipulates? Right? It would be a remiss for us to ignore that once you win a beauty pageant, you give up your life for a year. Everything you do has to be approved by the owners of the beauty pageant, which in this case is Stephanie Weil, W-E-I-L, Stephanie Weil, owner of the Nine Squad Communications Company and CEO of Miss South Africa. So everything that Lalela Mswane wears, says, does, people she meets with, events she attends, what she posts on social media, who she has conversations with, has to be approved by the Miss South Africa organization. We would think she has autonomy, right, an agency. She doesn't. Everything has to be approved. This is why I'm not surprised that her voice has not been heard in this discussion on whether she goes to represent South Africa in a country that is seen as an apartheid state or not. That Weil, or Stephanie Weil, being the one speaking to the media about Mswane's participation in the competition and not Mswane herself, has been telling. We do not know how Mswane really feels about competing. We only know what Stephanie Weil, her boss, is saying. So that's what this is all about. And it's a very difficult situation. And one cannot blame her. One is going on about saying that, oh, she will be tempted with Zionist gifts, etc. But look at who owns the pageant, and take it from there. It doesn't take rocket science to figure that out. And speaking of Israel, well, Israel's lobby, you know, obviously in overdrive mode, especially in the United States, the UK, France, and other Western countries, right? The latest is that they're pushing Priti Patel, Britain's Home Secretary, to ban the Palestinian movement of Hamas, right, in Britain under the Terrorism Act. So Hamas has condemned the move by Britain towards banning the group as a terrorist organization, which could see supporters of the Palestinian movement face up to 14 years in prison. Just for being a supporter of Hamas, Home Secretary Priti Patel, who is known to be an Islamophobe, right, has now come up with this legislation, or is pushing this legislation, or wants to push this legislation through, that if you support Hamas, or you found to be a supporter of Hamas, you can face 14 years in prison. Okay, and she wants to take this to Parliament next week, and argued on Friday that it was not possible to distinguish between Hamas's political and military wings. Right? She called Hamas fundamentally and rabidly anti-Semitic, the famous word, anti-Semitic, adding that the proscription was required to protect the Jewish community. What about the Palestinian community? Right? So Hamas responded in a statement saying, instead of apologizing, meaning instead of Britain apologizing and correcting its historical sin against the Palestinian people, right, Britain supports the aggressors at the expense of its victims. That comment referred to the Balfour Declaration, of course, and the British Mandate, which it said handed the Palestinian lands to the Zionist movement, that which led to the creation of the State of Israel, or the illegal State of Israel. So resisting occupation by all available means, including armed resistance, is a right guaranteed by international law to people under occupation. So the group called on its supporters to condemn the UK's move, as it described Israel's occupation of Palestinian lands, forcible displacement of Palestinians, the demolition of their homes, and the siege of more than 2 million people in the Gaza Strip as terrorism. So Patel, who is currently in Washington, D.C., said her move was based upon wide range of intelligence, information, and also links to terrorism. The severity of that speaks for itself, she said. Now, in 2017, Patel was forced to resign as Britain's International Development Secretary after she failed to disclose meetings with senior Israeli officials during a private holiday trip to the country. She met then Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and then opposition leader Yair Lapid. So the Qassam Brigade's military wing of the Palestinian movement that rules the Gaza Strip have been banned in Britain since March 2001, which we know, but not the political part of Hamas. So an outright ban under the Terrorism Act of 2000 will bring the United Kingdom in line with the United States and the European Union. This is what she said. And if her bid is successful, just flying the Hamas flag, arranging to meet its members, or wearing clothing supporting the group will be outlawed. And what you do, you risk 14 years of imprisonment. So this is Priti Patel, who, by the way, is also totally anti-immigration, right? And this is such a contradiction, because where does she come from? She comes from Uganda. Her parents moved to Britain in the 60s. So at the end of the day, if an immigrant family who has come to Britain, right, because of the changing of the situation in Uganda, it turns out so that her family left Uganda before Idi Amin chased out all the Indian community, right? And now she comes from that immigrant stock, but now have, what we can say in layman's term, have become more whiter than white, if one wants to put it that way, right? Or more British than the British indigenous themselves, and wants to uphold, let me guess, British values, like how the French always say that we want to uphold French values. That's Priti Patel for you. Like Sergeant Javid, also absolute useless, and others. This is the problem, that when these people come to a, you know, that they're citizens of a country, they forget their roots and want to be more, should I say, pompous in their ways and their approach to society. And, well, of course, Islamophobia always tries to rear its ugly head. Just yesterday, a mosque in Germany's western city of Cologne was targeted in an arson attack, right? According to a statement by the police, security guards spotted the suspect in the early hours of the day outside a Cologne central mosque while he was pouring a liquid. Police said in a statement the suspect fled on foot after being spotted and left his bicycle behind with a can of gasoline and several lighters. The police appealed for witnesses and said camera footage will be used to identify the suspect. Cologne's most prominent mosque, which is run by the Turkish Muslim Umbrella Organization, which is known as the Turkish Islamic Union for Religious Affairs, has received numerous threat letters in recent years from right-wing extremists and neo-Nazi groups. A country of over 82 million people, Germany has the second largest Muslim population in Western Europe after France. Among the countries, nearly 5 million Muslims, 3 million of Turkish descent. So that's what happened in Germany yesterday. And of course, on another note, a Muslim man who was falsely accused of preaching extremism and hate received an official apology from the British government on Monday. And you know for which ministry? The Home Ministry. Under which person? Under Priti Patel. So in a press release in 2015, Salman Bhatt, the chief editor of the famous Islam21C website, was named by the government as a person who legitimizes terrorism. The government accepts that it was wholly false to allege that Bhatt, or Salman Bhatt, is an extremist, hate preacher who legitimizes terrorism, and therefore someone from whose influence students should be protected. This is according to Idli, legal counsel for the Home Secretary Priti Patel, who said in court that it is sorry for the harm caused to him, and in particular for the fact that the allegation was made and maintained for so long, for 6 years. That's how long it was maintained for. But upon Salman Bhatt's legal challenge to the false accusation by the UK government, the Home Office agreed to delete his name from the press release and pay Salman Bhatt compensation alongside legal costs. One of the clearest lessons of this case in particular is just how baseless the notion of extremism and therefore counterterrorism actually is. This is what Salman Bhatt said in responding to the settlement. I believe the discourse of extremism is dead. More and more people are realizing that it is a nebulous term used by the powerful to silence any thoughts, ideas or speech they do not like or cannot challenge without coercion. Right? It is hearsay of today. So this is what Priti Patel's Home Ministry gets up to in Britain. And she now wants to brand the Hamas political wing as a terrorist organization, wants to push it through parliament, and for whoever supports Hamas, as I said, by displaying a flag, by meeting Hamas officials or visitors, you can risk 14 years imprisonment. Anyway, we need to take a short ad break. We'll return shortly. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh to your listeners. Welcome back. Okay, well, now we're going on to the Middle East. Well, we know, especially for the past 10 years, ever since the Arab Spring and the start of the Syria war, the Middle East, North Africa region has been suckered into a bloody conflict of rivalry amongst Sunni Shia, especially egos between the two big players responsible for this, Iran and Saudi Arabia. And both sides are equally guilty, and both sides are wrong in this whole thing, because they both want to dominate the region. One wants to dominate with a Wahhabi Sunni agenda, the other one with a Shia agenda. And it's time that this rivalry stops. So a month ago, there has been a reaching out of these rivals, Iran and Saudi Arabia, where they were looking to break the ice. And what happened was that there were these diplomatic efforts to, of course, break the ice between the long-time rivals, Iran and Saudi Arabia, that have intensified in recent months with officials on both sides citing progress in talks brokered by Iraq. And the reason why Iraq has brokered these talks is because Iraq is fed up of foreign interference in their country ever since the overthrowing of Saddam Hussein back in 2003. Yes, of course, the Americans and the British came in and caused all hell to break loose, but we all know that Iran has been having considerable influence over the running of affairs in Iraq, and there's been interference from Saudi Arabia. So there have been these round of talks that have been taking place, and it's come to a point that whereby Iran is actually losing some of its grip on the Shia militias in Iraq. Right, and it's found that the recent assassination attempt, or should I say soon after the drone attack that was aimed at assassinating the Iraqi Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kadhimi, Iran joined the ranks of countries condemning the attack. So Tehran, which wields considerable military influence in Iraq, rushed Ismail Ghani, the leader of the elite Quds force, to Baghdad to calm the most dramatic escalation in months between the state and the pro-Iran militia groups. Now, you know who's Ismail Ghani? He's the successor to Qasem Soleimani. So it's not clear whether Iran had previous knowledge of this attack, but Tehran's subsequent stance following the assault suggested that the attack at least went ahead without Iran's full endorsement. Right? At a tumultuous time when Iran's influence in Iraq seems to be on the decline, Tehran's once firm grip on the Shia militias in the country is again brought into question. What happened in between was that, say from last month till now, was that Muqtada al-Sadr has been elected as the president of Iraq. And he has now said that, and being a famous Iraqi cleric Shia as well, says that he is dissolving armed factions that are not loyal to him, and amongst that are the pro-Iran factions. So he said that, he said yesterday that he was dissolving the promised Day Brigade, an armed faction loyal to him, and closing its headquarters, according to a statement published on his Twitter page. On Thursday, al-Sadr urged paramilitary groups to purge what he called undisciplined members and said non-state armed groups should hand in their weapons. So Iranian Shia-backed Muslim militias have been accused of an attempt to kill outgoing Iraqi Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kadhimi with an armed drone on November 7th. So they are now forming what they call a new militia, or should I say a new military group, and they want to focus entirely on looking at Iraq's national sovereignty. So the thing is that it's about time that these two countries that are responsible for bringing the region into chaos, Iran and Saudi Arabia, put aside their differences and bring about peace and see how they can bring stability into the region and let every other country go on with their lives. That's the most important thing. So that's what's been happening in the Middle East. Now, coming to America, yesterday was a very controversial court ruling. This youngster, 18-year-old Kyle Rittenhouse, was acquitted by a 12-member jury for murdering two people and attempted murder of another person at a rally that took place in the state of Wisconsin last year, August, right, whereby he came to this rally armed with a semi-automatic machine gun, right? And when he was told to leave, a bit of skirmishes broke out, and he fired and killed two people, attempted to kill another person, obviously being arrested, facing the might of the law, and he's been acquitted by the jury. And this is where a white person in America obviously gets what we call a fair trial. You must have heard the famous African-American slogan, a black man never gets a free trial in America. A black man never gets a free trial in America. And you can extend that to say that Muslims don't get a trial in America. Right? So imagine if this shooter, or this terrorist, if you want to call it this way, although he was acquitted, right, but he still killed two people. He's claiming self-defense. That's all he's done. But why did he go and attend a rally that was not for his kind, not for his ilk, which are generally the white supremacists, right? It was a rally basically along the Black Lives Matter movement, right, protesting against police brutality, right, in the wake of the shooting of a black African American in the back that paralyzed him, and 3 months after the famous George Floyd killing, right? So this rally was held by the Black Lives movement, right? And this guy comes along to provoke with his semi-automatic machine gun, right? He says he came there to see what was going on, so he carried the machine gun to protect himself. Why the hell did he go there in the first place? So the court and the jury is not looking at why he went there, that he provoked the situation. They're looking at his testimony and, of course, the way his lawyer twisted the whole thing. And basically, in America, if you do not have a unanimous 12-member jury verdict on a, then of course the verdict does not hold. So if 11 out of the 12 say he's guilty and one just has to say not guilty, it's not unanimous, and they have to obviously say that he's not guilty. Well, we're not getting too much of details as to how the jury was split on the matter, but this is how stupid the jury system is. And even lawyers in America, you know, say that the one of the most absurd legal systems is the American legal system of the jury system. So that's what happened here with Kyle Rittenhouse. And it's, of course, it's created a big uproar. The victims' families are all upset. Communities are upset. And it's warning that it may lead to more violence like what we saw last year. And this has all linked to do with Donald Trump and his pro-white supremacist entourage, if you want to call it that way, or his cabal. And this is where it's been fed up. And sad enough, you get Muslims, especially in this country, who will echo the sentiments of those white supremacists and say, well, it's a way of taking over America, that this Black Lives Matter movement is actually a creation of George Soros or the New World Order to basically affect Americans' sovereignty, whatever that's supposed to mean. And then you'll find that Rumble.com, which is the awe of those who actually, you know, were basically of the right wing, if you want to put it that way, of America, of the Republicans. It's the only platform that has Donald Trump's videos and hate mongering, right? People are quoting Rumble.com as source. It's the most dangerous thing to do. You basically part fueling the agenda of the right wing of America, and that's what it simply is. And coming to the famous Qanon, or Qanon, Q-A, capital Q, capital A-N-O-N, Qanon changes strategies and spreads globally. So according to my friend C.J. Relleman, whom I've mentioned on the show, and he's the he's championing pro-Islamic causes and fights around the world, wrote this article to say that he reports on how the appeal of this baseless conspiracy theory is taking hold in Australia, where anti-vaxxer protesters are using Qanon to speak out against lockdowns. So he says that the 6th January attack on the U.S. Capitol by Donald Trump supporters, white supremacists, and Qanon conspiracy theorists has inspired like-minded individuals throughout the Western Democratic Hemisphere. This includes the anti-vaccine protesters staging a 4-day protest outside Melbourne's State Parliament building since Saturday, right? Roughly 3,000 anti-vaxxers have marched through the city's central business district carrying asinine placards, waving Trump and right-wing American liberation flags, wearing red MAGA, Making America Great Again caps, and chanting Kwanan slogans. In both style and substance, Australia has witnessed a bizarre and terrifying reenactment of the violent attempts to overthrow the U.S. government. In the same way that pro-Trump Americans built a gallows while chanting hang Vice President Mike Pence, 10 months earlier, the protesters in Melbourne carried a prop gallows with three nooses hanging from it as a woman with a megaphone said, "I look forward to the day I see you dance on the end of the rope," referring to the Victoria State Premier Dan Andrews as onlookers cheered. So similar calls for Dan Andrews that were echoed on social media among these self-described freedom protesters who failed to realize that the city's world record long lockdown and stringent social distancing measures have melted away because 90% of the state has now been fully vaccinated. So according to Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison, who has mimicked Trump in refusing to condemn those threatening the lives of elected lawmakers, while they claim to be only concerned citizens, the appearance of dozens of placards carrying Conan slogans, including "Save Our Children" and "We Don't Take Orders from Pedophiles," tells an entirely different story, one signaling a growing reach and influence of the U.S.-based conspiracy movement, which has seamlessly and strategically embedded itself within anti-vaccine and white supremacist movements and groups during the coronavirus pandemic. Conan is a baseless far-right conspiracy theory that posits cannibalistic pedophiles are operating a global child sex trafficking ring, which Donald Trump was working to defeat. So COVID-19 restrictions are being exploited by extreme right-wing narratives that paint the state as oppressive and globalization and democracy as flawed and failing, warned ASIO, the country's top intelligence agency, earlier this year. We assess that the COVID-19 pandemic has reinforced an extreme right-wing belief in the inevitability of societal collapse and a race war. So in May, ASIO Director General Mike Burgess told a Senate hearing that the threat from the right-wing racists and nationalists represents roughly 50% of its current counterterrorism onshore caseload, saying that this reflects a growing international trend as well as ASIO's decision to allocate more resources to the threat. So this threat is metastasizing in the form of both formal and informal right-wing groups and movements, including Conan and neo-Nazi organizations, which have taken full advantage of conspiracy theories that have spread throughout the Australian community during the crisis, particularly those related to vaccines and 5G technologies. Right? As these conspiracy theory groups have grown and inspired rallies around the country, members of the far right are working to bring people across the right-wing extremist ideology. This is an observation by investigative journalist Mario Castellulu. So Cam Smith, a researcher and journalist, has monitored the growing of Conan in Australia since he first noticed the conspiracy group popping up in local communities and in his Facebook feed in 2018. Having tracked their online conversations, he told The Guardian how a group of Conan believers drove nearly 2,000 kilometres from Queensland to Victoria to protest against Melbourne's lockdown in early July 2020, finding themselves and expounding their theories as they went. So that's all we have time for, but just to get the essence of this, that the right-wing groups are using, or should I say misusing, the approach to coronavirus pandemic as a way of political point scoring. And they are using this to confuse people. And one of the biggest platforms is this Rumble.com, which incidentally is owned by one of Trump's friends. And it's there, but what the right wing forgets to, or should I say, what people forget, that the right wing is responsible for a lot of Western democracies' heavy-handed measures on the people. So what you're seeing is a consequence of right-wingism. And the thing is, don't be surprised that now the right wing, who have always been in the wrong, are now trying to claim the moral high ground to show that they are the angels, like what we saw with this recent Human Rights Commission inquiry into the July riots that is taking place, focusing solely on Phoenix, whereby it's an ANC effort to sanitize or claim the moral high ground. That's what it's all about. That's all I have time to. A special thanks to Brother Ziad at our Lens Studio, the engineer, and Jazakallah. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.